Welcome to the Paris of the Plains. From Kansas City, I'm your host. Paris of the Plains podcast is dedicated to telling unheard audio stories from the people of Kansas City. Tonight's stories are about facing sudden and intense tragedy. Whether it's a relationship gone wrong, an industrial accident, or dealing with mental illness, tragic stories have always helped us to understand the sadness in our own lives and show us a door through which to come out on the other side. Our first story tonight comes from Blair.
All right. So I guess this all started in August of 2014. I needed to meet more people, and so I ended up going on Tinder. And I happened to come across this one guy that seemed really interesting. He had a bunch of pictures of him and his dog, and I have a dog, so instant connection there. And then looking through some of his other photos, he climbs and he's really passionate about being outdoors. And there's something that's always driven me to be around those types of people, because they're always driven themselves. They're always passionate about what they do. And a couple weeks before he asked me to be his girlfriend, he had asked me to meet for coffee. And we met for coffee, and over coffee, he said, "Let's just do it. I'm ready to jump in. If you're ready to jump in, I feel this weird natural connection that cannot be explained, and I just have to roll with it, and I have to remind myself that, you know, to take it slow, but I really want to just have this happen now." And he looked at me, and he's like, "So are you going to jump in? Are you going to do this with me?" And I said, at first, I was hesitant at first, just because I've never had someone point blank ask me, "Are you willing to do this with me? Do you want this relationship?" Putting all of my worries aside and just saying, you know, this is only feeling weird because it's different. This is something that I have always wanted, and now that it's in my face, I'm going to run from it. Like, that's stupid. So I said, "Sure, let's do it. Let's make sure that we make room for each other in our lives. And then down the line, maybe we can start dating in a couple weeks, or, you know, or maybe even now. I don't know." There was one day in particular that I remember. We had set plans to meet up and just walk around my neighborhood. I lived in the River Market at the time. Delaware Street is probably the cutest street ever. I love it. And so I decided to take him down that street just because it meant so much to me. And sure enough, we come across a little thrift shop on the corner. And one of the things that we actually stopped to look at was just a pile of old pictures. Recently, I've been drawn to photography, and I kind of, you know, had a passion for it at one point. So when I stopped to look at the things, the photographs, he had stopped too, and he said that his grandparents used to collect old photos, and they actually took those photos and they kind of hung them around the house and things like that. And so we kind of went back and forth discussing ideas of what we could do with these old photos. You know, we thought of like finding photos or postcards that had locations on them and then traveling to go to those places and, you know, take a new picture and make stories for ourselves. And so it was with that that outing that we kind of had a moment where we kind of grew together, or we had more reason for us to make future plans together. And I think we both felt like that was a moment in time where we felt motivated, and gosh, I don't even know how to say it. It just was a turning point in everything that we were doing together, because he's not the first guy that I've said I love you to, but he was the first guy that I actually felt it with like my whole being. You know, with the other people, it was kind of a mixture of infatuation, and then also I felt like we were both trying to play roles. With this one, it just felt like it was effortless, and things were falling into place naturally, and I felt like I could withstand anything that came our way, because we were a team, and that's how we talked. We talked as if we could face the world together, and I've never experienced that with someone. But this was the one moment where we clearly stated in more ways than one that we wanted to build a house together, we wanted to travel together, we wanted to support each other's careers, and all within one conversation about old photographs and family and what it meant to us. And okay. All right. So at a certain point in our relationship, it was fairly early in our relationship when he had called me to tell me that his dad was going in for testing, and he would get test results back in about a week. And when I asked him about the test, exactly what was it, or, you know, how was it going to affect his family, he didn't really have a lot of answers for me. He just kind of decided to keep it to himself. But a week later, he called me to tell me that his dad had cancer. And so we were going through all of the options and what his family was going to face over the next couple months. We had this understanding where if either one of us was uncomfortable, all we had to do was say no. And then we would just remain friends or keep in contact or just end everything. And he started to kind of retract into himself, and he started to put up a wall. It just became very difficult to talk about. And so within a short span of time, we had gone from acquaintances to really good friends to, you know, falling in love. And then now we've hit this area that was just unknown. I felt like I was floating. And it was around January 21st that we were supposed to meet, and he ended up texting me telling me, you know, hey, I am so sorry, but my dad is, you know, a little distant, and he's confused about who everyone is, and they really need someone at the hospital right now. And it was around 8 o'clock. You know, we had been texting all day, and at around 8 o'clock, I had asked him, you know, is everything good? Are we still good to meet? And he just replies 10 minutes later, no, nothing's fine. And it wasn't until like 2 hours later that I got the words, dad is going. And instantly, like, I fell apart. I'm sitting on this futon with my friends about to watch a movie, and the person I care about most right now is telling me that, you know, the person that he has grown up to, you know, idolize is just falling away from him. So for the next 2 weeks, I get a total of 2 texts. The first one saying, I'm not going to handle this the best way, but I'm going to try. And the second text is on the latter part of those 2 weeks that I didn't hear from him. And it was just saying, you know, I'm not handling this the correct way. You don't deserve this. I'm so sorry. So he had told me that he was going to go to the Patagonia region, a trip that he had planned many months before, but he got in an accident and had to have surgery. And so he had not really had the opportunity to go. And upon hearing this, my first reaction was bullshit, straight up bullshit, because he had not been climbing in months. He had not been on, you know, he was not prepared to make this trip. And so I called him out on it, and I said, what are you saying? Like, you cannot do this trip because you're not prepared. And he stopped me, and he's like, Blair, like, seriously, this is what I'm trying to tell you. And this is why I was late today and I never showed up, because I set my phone on airplane mode so you couldn't contact me because I was having a breakdown. And he said, you know, Blair, at the end of the week, I was going to do a solo climb, and I was not going to come back alive. And it was at that point that he started to cry, and he broke down, and he said that, I'm going to call you back. And he just hung up. I was frantic, because how do I get him back on the phone? How do I get him to cancel his trip? What can I do or say? So then I think, he's closest to his sister, I'll call her. And the first question she asks me is, you know, like, what's going on? What's happening? And then when I tell her that, you know, your brother's, you know, threatening suicide by going on this grand trip and, you know, going on a solo climb and not coming back, what do I do? You know, her next question was, did you ever see the plane ticket? And that's when I kind of sat back and I was like, what? Who asked that? What sister asked that to, you know, imply that their brother's lying? Like, that's stupid. that's overwhelmingly, you know, naive. Like, we need to solve this issue at hand. And it was at that point that I told her, you know, like, a suicide threat is still a suicide threat. Please reach out to him and make sure that he's okay. And she said, well, that's exactly what I did when I first heard that you had called my restaurant. I had reached out to my father. I stopped her right then and there, and I said, wait, your father, you talked to him today? And she said, yeah, I told him about the call that I just got from you. And I had just stopped in my tracks. I don't really know, but I ended up telling her, you know, I'm so sorry for interrupting, but I've been under the influence that, or like, I've thought that your dad was dead. And she said, oh, that's a new one. And so I had assumed that he lived in Lawrence and that he had lost his dad to cancer. Those things are all false. He lives with his parents. I don't know exactly if he's working at this point, but one of the companies that he had stated he worked for is actually the company that his dad had worked for. And this is so weird. Stop it for a second. And that's the last time I've ever heard from him. It's weird knowing that I have answers to things that he doesn't know I have answers to. Like, I know more than he even knows that I know. And yet, he's still not calling me. He's still not texting me. And that's so different from every other time that we've had an argument. It's with that silence that I know that he is ashamed of something, that he is hiding another life, and he doesn't want to face that yet. I definitely miss there are moments where I knew for certain that he was being truthful, that he was reacting to me in an honest way. And, you know, he had written me a letter at one point telling me about, you know, how I have an effect on him and how capable I am of anything, and how together we can really work towards a future. When people ask me if I miss him or if I have a hard time with it, you know, on the surface, I'm not really having that bad of a time with it. I carry on, I do everything normally, but, you know, I kind of just take him with me wherever I go, because he gave me a lot of courage and he gave me a lot of my personality back. You know, I felt like I was in kind of a slump. And in knowing him, he kind of inspired a lot of things that I didn't really know existed inside me. So I miss him.
Up next on our program, Saul Koenigsberg is a survivor of the Hyatt Hotel Skywalk collapse. On July 17, 1981, 114 people were killed and 200 injured when the Skywalk fell. It was the deadliest structural collapse in U.S. history until September 11th, 2001.
I was at the Hyatt Hotel tea dance on July 17th, 1981, along with my wife. And she was still grieving from the loss of her father. Her father fought in the French army and was captured by the Germans and was in a German prisoner of war camp for 5 years, and she loved him dearly. And I said, let's try to ease some of your grieving and entertain ourselves with a tea dance. We turned up at the tea dance at around 6 o'clock or so. It was announced that there was going to be a contest. We didn't want to engage ourselves in a contest. So we stood on the sidelines, and the sidelines were under the skywalk. The band started playing Satin Doll, a Duke Ellington piece.
It's called Satin Doll.
Well, the tea dance was mainly for people in middle age they actually held on to each other when they danced. Not like today. People dance all by themselves with all kinds of gyrations. They can be enjoying themselves. But we, in our middle age, love to dance with swing, with rumba, all the ballroom dances. And the this is a big band that played, Steve Miller's band. And people would come out to enjoy themselves. This was something that was started some weeks before we went. And the dancers, the contestants, started to dance. About 3 minutes later, everything went dark. I didn't hear a thing. The next thing I knew, I couldn't move. I was buried under debris. My wife was too. But some of the debris fell around her, and she saw a person crawling out. And she just followed that person. So she was not physically hurt. My black shoes were showing out of the debris, and hotel staff and all the volunteers pulled me out. And I learned that my back had been broken in 3 places with compressed fractures. My left leg was crushed, and I had some internal injuries. My wife was stayed with me. We were taken by stretchers, and somebody put me on a serving platter and put me on the sidewalk with her. And that famous picture was taken of us holding hands. And, you know, they had a triage development where people were evaluated whether or not this was, their life was in danger, and they were moved up first. And we were on the sidewalk for a couple of hours. And Mayor Berkeley came running to the scene, and the first people he saw were my wife and me on the sidewalk. And somebody came up and said, are these families? He says, no, they're friends. And he almost went into shock. This was a, you know, very, very difficult time for him as mayor. My wife, however, went into shock. And I nearly lost her. From then on, she suffered from post-traumatic stress syndrome on top of the post-traumatic stress system she already suffered. My wife was a young girl in France during the war and the Nazi occupation, and she had to hide and underwent the horrors of being chased by the SS and the Nazis, who were trying to find her and kill her just because she was Jewish. She managed to survive, however, but that experience stayed with her, and she had nightmares about it just about every night, along with the nightmares she had with the Hyatt collapse of the skywalk. She had those nightmares until she died last year. And then when I was in the hospital, a number of doctors surrounded my bed and said, well, you survived. You must have something to do. And my response was, and those people who were killed didn't? And then, about 2 days after I was in the hospital, I had a flashback. I was in the Navy in World War II and served on a destroyer escort, and we were under attack again. But that only lasted for about 10 minutes. I never had a flashback again. So I associated the disaster we were in with my combat experience. But that's all behind us. It took me about a year to fully recover. And that was because I had a very excellent surgeon. He fixed my leg up and told me I would never walk without a limp. What did he know? I went, got up every morning at 5:30 and went swimming. And then from swimming, I went to physical therapy every morning. From there, I went to my office. And I went and went and suffered the agony of these exercises that my physical therapist put me through. But I don't limp. And then I learned that a couple of men were working on an actual memorial. And they put an item in the newspaper, in the Kansas City Star, and said, we are starting up this committee, and we'd like to know if there's anybody interested in joining us. Well, I had 42 years of experience in fundraising, and since I was a survivor, I volunteered. We didn't have many other people volunteering, and we began to lay out a plan. They had already gotten underway and started the fundraising, and they found that the fundraising was being met with a lot of resistance. There was no personal identification with it, and a lot of people wanted to put it behind them. Too painful. There are people now in their 20s and 30s who never heard of this. And we are determined with the building of this memorial that they know that this historical event happened in Kansas City and that people responded. Volunteers came out in droves. People lined up at the blood center to give blood. The media was all over the place. 30 years later, that's not the case. My wife knew that I was working on it and frequently said, look, you've been retired now for a number of years. You've been raising money for many, many years. And I hear you being rejected so many times. What do you need this for? You've had enough already. But I said, you know, when we start a job, we're going to finish whatever time it takes. My wife developed a couple of years ago. We found that she had lung cancer and was discovered. It was already in stage 4. And I lost her in January of 2014, after 62 years of marriage. We went to the attorneys who represented the survivors and some of the people killed, and other private individuals, and were able to raise the most money needed to really start the construction. There remains, however, another amount, and I would estimate it's something like between $50,000 and $100,000 needs to be raised in order to ensure the maintenance. But we have the money to build the memorial, so we're building it. And now we're beginning to work on collecting the remaining amount that's due. Put what I said in other terms, I'd want people of all ages, people from this metropolitan area, people from schools, universities, to come sit at the memorial and think about that horrible night when the skywalk came down and crushed people to death. And at the same time, remember the community did come together. And it should never, never be forgotten, generation after generation.
Our third story tonight is by reporter Esther Honig and is a touching tribute to her father. This story is called The Time Traveler's Ark and won KCRW's International Radio Race in 2015.
Do you know where you were born?
Yeah, I was born in San Francisco.
Okay. And what, do you remember what year?
I think it was 1452.
Hey, Dad, do you know what day it is today?
Yeah. January 19th, 1951. I was born in January 19th, 1951.
This is my dad, Jordan Honig, and for the last 4 or 5 years, he's been displaced in time. Do you remember when you first started to get Alzheimer's?
I didn't get Alzheimer's.
You didn't?
No.
You could almost say he's a time traveler because he slips through time and space. Sometimes you might even catch him in the present, but it depends, I guess. So for the past year, he's lived in a nursing home, and it's this tiny little corridor. It's the type of place where there's linoleum flooring and then fluorescent lights, and there's hardly any windows. It's the sort of place where the scenery never really changes.
And anything important that we should know about this year, 1951?
There really was a big wave. I was the first person to start creating things to eat. Just everything I could think of that you would need to be in an ark.
Oh, this is the Ark story.
It's, yes.
The story of the Great Ark.
Yes.
And then the wave, the tidal wave came. That was the tidal wave you were talking about earlier.
Yes, the tsunami.
And you had your ark built.
Yes, the ark was already built, and it's still running.
So he's talked about the ark before. I started documenting my dad around the time that he was diagnosed when he was 60. And he's had these reoccurring themes. And one of them is the great flood, or maybe sometimes it's a tsunami wave, and the ark. This is taped from him 4 years ago.
In your adolescence, you went to Israel too, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And we were looking at what was left of the ark. And in the ark, we found not just Israeli coins, but Bedouin coins.
He did actually go to Israel when he was out of college. But of course, finding the ark is a bit of an elaboration. But at different stages, he's been building the ark. Or maybe he's been searching for the ark, but now he's progressed to sailing the ark, and it's this need to escape the impending tsunami, this wave that's going to come at him and crash down over everything.
It was a way of keeping alive. Yes,
seems like that's kind of what's happening in your head a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And as you got everything that you could onto mm-hmm. the ark,
and then
wave came,
they go.
To lose my dad in this way makes me wonder, what is a person without time? Who do we become without a present or a past? Just lost at sea.
February 28th, 2016 marked the 28th anniversary of when KKFI first went on the air. It was also the day that three KKFI volunteers, Sharon Lockhart, Ebony Johnson, and Beth Wilkerson, traveled to Austin, Texas with radio equipment that KKFI was no longer using. That equipment was then fixed up and shipped off to a community radio station in Ghana where it could be put to use. To help us celebrate, we bring you an encore broadcast of WINGS, the Women's International News Gathering Service, normally aired on Saturday afternoons at 2:30 on KKFI, about the very community radio station that KKFI's equipment is at. Here now is that program.
On August 10th, 2015, the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters will hold an international conference in Accra, Ghana. Here's an example of what delegates will learn about community radio in that country.
Community radio, community radio, we work with our people, we work.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to WINGS, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Lydia Ajono is a longtime practitioner of community radio from Ghana in Africa. I had the good fortune to interview her at a World Community Radio Conference in Argentina. She told me she had won the trip as a prize thanks to a script competition run by Farm Radio International. She is also a past contributor to WINGS, but her real passion is for helping her own community. Here's how Lydia got her start in community radio back in the days when she was the only woman on the local airwaves.
Well, I started as a volunteer way back in the 80s. I used to do small reports on farm news in my native language. And we didn't have a frequency to operate community radio by then. So I used to do a show on the rural FM station from the government side after the 12 o'clock news. Then I ran it for 30 minutes. And it was water is life. Water was very scarce. to get water for just a bucket, you had to travel way into the night, leave your house in the night before you can get a bucket of water. Then it was the time that the Canadian government with the government of Ghana came together to provide water to these rural communities. So Water is Life was to get the communities to appreciate borehole water.
Would you say what a borehole is?
Yeah, heavy machinery has been used to drill deep down to the water table, sometimes 600 feet, and then they'll put a tube down and then have a simple pump. And then you stand on it or hold the bar and pump the water out. But the perception of the community members was that that water, borehole water, was not tasty. So they weren't drinking from the borehole, but they were still drinking from these streams. And sometimes they don't get that water and they will refuse to drink the borehole water.
I want to know how you convinced the people to drink the water even though they didn't like the taste.
Well, diarrhea was very prominent for both children and adults. A family, I quite remember, lost their two children out of the diarrhea. And I went and interviewed them on a reel-to-reel recorder, very heavy. So I had to put it on my bicycle to record the family, their experience. Then when I brought it back and played it back, it touched hearts. And mothers were coming to ask, so what can we do? So I used to go to the antenatal clinics to meet with mothers and talk with them and then share that on the radio. And that played the trick. They started drinking, trying the water. They would go to a borehole and fetch the water and say, especially this is for drinking. And they were using that, and the children were getting healthy. Diarrhea had reduced. And at the antenatal clinics, there was the response that, well, people were now drinking the water and they were really getting healthy and no diseases. So people started, you know, drinking the water. So my show was a 30-minute show. Every day I will host a nutritionist and one of the water experts, and then also a community member. So that's the trick that we used.
I'm Frieda Worden, and you're listening to my interview with Lydia Adjono, a community radio broadcaster from Ghana. When you look at her face closely, you see a diagonal scar line on one cheek. In this next section of our interview, she calls that her mask. So where in Ghana did you grow up, and where were you living when you were doing this first radio work?
I am from the northern part of Ghana, and for that matter, the Upper East region. I was born and raised in a city, but very early of my educational period, my father thought I would get lost in the city. So he transported us back to the rural area. That's why I have this mark, so that I don't get lost. So I went to school in the Walkatanga Girls Secondary School. And after that, I was to go to Agriculture Institute. That was my selection. I wanted to do agriculture and nutrition. Mm-hmm. But the coup in 1979 really disrupted my education. So for almost 10 years, I couldn't go to any institute. It really displaced me personally. But as a transition, I had this radio program, picked it up, and I started working on it. But as I entered into the radio, I was more empowered, and I was ready to learn and improve myself, whether I went to higher institution or not. So that's how I continued.
The school's loss was radio's gain.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned, because you mentioned that you have a mark on your face, would you say what this is, and does it relate to the rural culture there?
Yes, in our area that I come from, in Ghana, in the colonial days, way back when the British were ruling us, even before then, there was this slave trade. And my tribe was one of the strongest tribe, and the slave raiders attacked my tribe. They defended, but it was too strong. They were more strong because they were using weapons, guns, and they were having their simple instrument. So a lot of our people were arrested and sold out as slaves. So with that experience, they started marking every child that was born, even way after the slave trade, to give them identity. In case you were gone or you were arrested and sold as a slave, you should be able to trace back to your tribe. And right now, if I go anywhere in Argentina here, and then I have one of my tribe members, they will know where I come from, and we will recognize each other. And we have different marks to signify from a certain bigger tribe, and then it tells in the bigger tribe which area I come from.
So when you started doing radio, were you doing it in your tribal area?
Yes, it covers a very big area. And just to give you a picture of it, a district is like a local authority area. We have about 9 of such in my tribe area. So I was doing the program in my language. And then for the expert workers and the NGOs that were coming into the area, I had like a 15-minute program in English just to summarize some of the major issues happening in the city. Because that time it was so difficult to access news or any information. There were no internet, there were nothing. The national radio station had a monitoring service. Thus, we can monitor from the city, and then we can get BBC news at dawn, and then we can summarize that and then present it.
So you became an all-around news person. So you started also filing stories internationally. When did that happen?
Yes, I started filing stories internationally when I really met you. I tried my first story, I can remember, and I saw that, I can do it. So every opportunity I had, I did.
I'm Frieda Worden of Wings, talking with Lydia Adjono, a Ghanaian community radio broadcaster. We first met each other at a World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters conference in 1997 in Milan. And shortly thereafter, Lydia sent Wings a story on cassette in the mail. By the time we had this interview at another community radio conference in Argentina, Lydia was an award-winning reporter using internet to file her stories abroad.
Then my internet filing story started just about 2-3 years ago. I found from Farm Radio International that I could do that. It was so difficult to go into the internet and be able to hook the net for long. So I would do the editing, the script, and then I'll go to the studio and read it to make sure that I will have very few errors to correct. And then from there, then I will go to a cafe and sit there for hours and then be able to come out with my story and send it. Then last year, I realized that, wow, there are other internet facilities that you can send audio material. You send it is one that I was able to try, and I was so proud of myself that I was able to send an interview of about 5 minutes to CBC in Canada on the World Women's Day. I also sent one for AMAC, and then I've also filed one for the World Food Day.
Wow, so this is a lot of change, technological change from recording on open reel in the field until you're sending your stories on the internet. Tell me a bit about Ghana and what's been going on in Ghana lately, and how does that affect your area where you live?
Right now in Ghana, let me say politically, it's stable. We have a very dynamic professor president, a lawyer by profession, and a tax specialized lawyer. He has been in the politics for a long period. He was for 8 years a vice president, and now the last election in 2008, he became the president. At the economic side, things are changing. Since 2004-05, oil has been found in Ghana. And it is the talk of the town. And where I live, the Upper East, we are not near the oil area. So our communities don't really understand what it means. So we normally pick some of this information to let them understand what is happening.
While Lydia's community is not in the oil region, there are still opportunities coming from oil and oil wealth, and she helps the community to recognize such.
There's this gas pipeline being constructed from Ghana to Burkina, and it has to pass through our region to Burkina. So the gas pipeline, because it's passing through all the communities, the company that is contracted to do that go around to contract the community youth labor to construct the trench where they can lay the pipe or whatever they want to do. So some of the communities resisted because they used to bring other youth from different regions to come to those communities. They said, no, we cannot be here, we have no jobs, and you go and bring other people to come and do that. So there were a little bit of conflict, and we had to host those issues on the radio, the oil, how it impacts on their community life, and how they have to challenge some of the political decisions that might not benefit them.
Was that campaign successful? Now they use the local youth?
Yes, it is. It is successful. So the local youth is now being used at every community that they have gotten to dig the trench. They don't bring any different person. They mobilize the youth around there to dig the trench. And if they are going to do anything that has to do with labor, either the youth or the women or the men, they have to do it, and they can give them some small money. The government is also having a program. They call it the Community Level Manpower Road Construction. They are trying to implement that. And for our region, we are celebrating our 50th anniversary. So the municipal assembly mobilized all the community members where the roads are all going through to work on the roads. And then the capital of the region, which is Bolgatanga, for so many years has been in darkness. Recently, everywhere has gotten street lights, and they are still continuing to put more street lights.
Lydia's community radio in Ghana not only mobilizes people and provides information, it also helps make peace.
Where I come from, one part of it for the past 10 years, on and off, has experienced tribal conflict based on chieftaincy, you know, power relations, chieftaincy disputes. And it really caused a lot of havoc. A lot of lives were lost, family against family, and it was really very, very serious. But now the situation is under control, and my station, we have been working with some of the community women groups to do radio programs to promote peace and reconciliation and to bring healing to the community. And that program is ongoing. And then the women at the community level have group meetings. They engage themselves into income-generating activities that they work together to reconcile and bring unity and unite their families that has been displaced. So we have been working with the Regional Peace Council and the District Peace Initiatives to bring permanent peace to the place. The other program that I can say in my region, and I proudly want to say that if only the government will really push it and it will work, is the food security issue. And they've launched what they call the Savannah Agriculture Authority. Some of the funding is coming from the United States of America Millennium Challenge account, which they launched for Ghana to increase food production and also to improve on road networks so that small-scale farmers can cut their crops from the hinterlands into the town for sale, because the roads are very bad. So part of this project is to improve road network. That is a program that has been recently launched. We hope that it will be well implemented. And my radio station, we are trying to involve so that we can work with the communities that will be part of this food production program, improving livelihood. The other aspect I will want to talk about under the economic aspect is tourism. In tourism, in my region, we have a lot of attraction areas, and we are promoting ecotourism because we have a lot of natural places that have not been harnessed. So we are promoting that so that at least some kind of improvement can be put into it, and then the road network improves so that it can attract tourists visiting. And we are also concerned about climate change, which is a real issue in our area, because recently we had a lot of flooding, very heavy rains that came and destroyed a lot of farmlands and properties. And we know it is part of this global warming thing. So we are working with the communities to understand the global phenomena and then to be able to do something about it by adapting, you know, because crops that were really their stable food are no more producing well. So they have to think of strategies that they can improve upon crop production, they can improve upon their livelihood. So these are some of the critical issues that we are looking at. Environmental issues are very, very critical because we are nearer to the desert, because after Burkina, Mali, and we are in the desert. Desertification is affecting us very much. We are losing a lot of our forest because of drought and because of the influence of global warming. So about 2 months ago, they launched the National Environmental Protection Program in my region. And the communities are coming together to work together. Like five communities will group together so that they'll be able to help each other. In the area of women and children, we are working to reduce malaria, if not completely eradicate malaria, which is a big issue, and child and maternal mortality. Recently, UNICEF brought together media practitioners to train us and let us have more information that we can do programs and write stories about child and maternal mortality issues, that policy makers can look at them and then formulate policy that will help to reduce these incidents. UNICEF strategy is communication for development that I was part of the training program, and we are working with the Health Directorate to do a lot of programs at the community level with the community members themselves.
Another radio project involves supporting a community health nurse who persuaded women to come to the clinic for birthing by incorporating traditional practices into the clinic experience.
I'm trying to get to the community after the rains to talk to them about this and do a story. In this community, traditionally, if a woman delivers, there's this millet, a grain called millet. They will prepare the flour and they will mix it with hot water, like a beverage. Mm-hmm. very hot for the woman to drink. And then after drinking, they believe that after that it will help heal all your womb again. So she prepares that in quantities. So if you come to deliver at a clinic, you drink a lot of that. So it attracted the woman. Instead of staying in the house to deliver, they go to the clinic now. And in that community, maternal mortality has really reduced because of that strategy she has used. And these are simple models that they are adapting, going back to adapt some of these best practices of the communities, then they can use them. And that is actually helping to reduce some of these incidents.
Community radios in Ghana also take up issues of mental health.
Mental health is a very big issue, and many people don't know that everybody is prone to some kind of mental illness. I went out to work with an NGO called Basic Needs Ghana, and then we have another one, local NGO called Pride. So we do programs, we have a radio program that is on mental health. They have 30 minutes of discussion and then they open the phone line for interaction. But the highest aspect is that is affecting our productive youth, which is a concern. Also, in the area of youth employment, there has been issues of incidents of illicit drug abuses, both out of school and in school. I've written a story about that for the International Day of Mental Health. And then people living with disabilities. Since last year, I've been part of the Ghana Community Radio Network, and we are promoting the establishment of community radios in the community. And in my area, we have facilitated about two of such communities. At one session, we had about 10 people with disabilities involved, and two of them are part of the management team. And then at my radio station, people with disabilities, they also have a radio program every week, which comes on Saturdays in the evening. That is also what I can say we are doing there.
Serving the community in so many ways. Maybe you'd like to wrap up a little bit, tell one of your favorite moments in community radio.
One of my favorite moments in community radio is really getting community to understand that it is their right to make use of airwaves. It's a natural product. I mean, they're using the airwaves. It is a natural product in every country that they have to access it. And they said, oh, we didn't know that. And I was part of that team that has facilitated about 12 communities. And they are moving towards of acquiring frequencies to operate community radios. That is my most happiest and delightful moment.
Lydia Adjono, you are a true community radio woman and a very successful one. I'm so happy to see you smiling proudly. Thank you so much for your interview with the Wings.
Thank you, too.
After our interview at the community radio conference in Argentina, Lydia Adjono went outside to take her turn on a live broadcast of women's radio from the streets of La Plata.
Thank you so much. Oh, thank you so much. In Ghana, we always display gender balance. And our community radios, all the community radios in Ghana, we came together and we formed a song. And the song goes like this. And I'm going to do it with Kofi Lawe to show how we implement our gender policy.
Lidia Ajono, que viene de la red de radios comunitarias de Ghana, quiere cantarnos la canción que siempre cantan antes de empezar la transmisión de radio en su emisora. Le va a acompañar
Kofi Lawe.
Kofi Lawe.
Community Radio.
Community Radio, a different kind of radio. We work with our people. Community Radio. Community Radio. We work with our people. We work with our people. Together we design. Together we decide. Together we implement. With our people. Together we plan. Together we decide. Together we implement. We work with our people. Community Radio.
To learn more about community radio worldwide, visit the website www.amarc.org. That's AMARC.org. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
And you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the local showcase.